Hello, and welcome to Science World. NASA announced this past week that its Kepler Space Telescope discovered a record 715 new exoplanets orbiting some 305 stars. For over the last year and a half, as many as 25 children in California have been stricken with a mysterious polio-like virus that has caused paralysis in five of the youngsters. And Dr. Boris Finotzer from Virginia Tech has developed what some call a revolutionary biological naming and classification system. It's one that helps scientists better communicate with each other about life on Earth. Today, we'll talk with Dr. Finotzer about his new system and the benefits it could provide. These stories and more are coming up for you on VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. This past Wednesday, NASA announced that its planet-hunting Kepler Space Telescope hit the jackpot when it found and verified a record of 715 new planets orbiting some 305 stars. Science World's Doug Bernard has more.
NASA astronomers carefully searched and analyzed observational data that was recorded by the space telescope between 2009, when its mission began, and 2011. Some of the stars that were observed had multiple planets orbiting it, much like our own solar system. This record-setting find boosted the number of known worlds beyond our solar system to nearly 1,700. Nearly 95% of the newfound planets are smaller than Neptune, but four of them are about 2.5 times bigger than Earth and are located within what scientists call the habitable zone. That's just the right distance from their parent stars for liquid surface water to form, which is an important element for life. Launched in 2009, the Kepler Space Telescope, after looking at about 160,000 target stars, discovered a total of 961 confirmed planets located outside of our solar system. Unfortunately, Kepler had to be taken out of service last summer because of mechanical problems that had developed with its pointing system. For Science World, I'm Doug Bernard.
Germany is one of the top producers of renewable energy in the world, but German consumers are also paying among the highest electricity prices in the European Union. Science World's Bob Doty has this report from Anna Hans Ward.
Lissy Eschang started turning off appliances to save energy when she moved away from home a decade ago. Back then, Lissy's family was paying half the price Germans pay today for electricity, and this year, German consumers are expected to pay even more. Today, an average family of four in Germany spends about $107 a month for electricity. This year, their monthly bill will be $129, almost three times more than a family in the United States. The price hike is due to an increase in the renewable energy surcharge. The surcharge is one of many government fees, taxes, and subsidies that are passed on to average consumers and fund Germany's renewable energy sector. Niels Schnorr is a policy officer with the Federation of German Consumer Organizations in Berlin. He says Germany's aggressive expansion into green energy, expensive offshore wind farms, and generous subsidies will continue to drive up energy prices.
Partly, the high energy prices are due to mistakes made by the government. If we had focused from the very beginning on the cheap technologies, then probably the energy prices would not be as high as they are at the moment.
A recent government study found that 8% of Germany's electricity comes from wind farms, mostly in northern Germany and the North Sea, where winds are strong. Over 4% comes from solar energy, especially from southern Germany and Bavaria, where many homes and public buildings are covered with solar panels. The rest of the renewable energy is generated by hydropower, biofuels, and biomass plants. Paul Hockenes is an energy expert and journalist based in Berlin. He says building a green energy infrastructure like wind and solar parks is expensive, but once in place, Germans can expect not just lower prices, but also greater energy independence.
Don't forget, what Germany is doing right now is it's changing its power supply. I mean, the last time an energy supply was changed was the Industrial Revolution. You know, this is something that's never been done before. And, you know, Germany isn't just any country when it comes to heavy industry and export prowess, et cetera. Yes, there are price increases, but last year, I mean, Germany is obviously still competitive on the international market. I mean, last year it exported more goods and services than it ever had before in its history. It also exports electricity.
In the aftermath of the Japanese tsunami and Fukushima disaster in 2011, Chancellor Angela Merkel renewed Germany's pledge to abandon nuclear power and shut down 8 of its 17 nuclear reactors. Germany plans to completely phase out its nuclear energy production in the next decade. The government's goal is that by 2050, 80% of electricity will come from renewable sources. Niels Schnoor says that will be possible only if Germany abandons its costly approach for a more cost-effective green energy industry.
We have to focus on the very cost-effective technologies, which, in my opinion, are wind power and solar power. We don't need other renewable sources in order to achieve the goals of the energy transition in Germany.
Some would say Germany's transformation from a fossil fuel to a green economy is a success. For Anna Hans Ward, I'm Bob Doty.
Over the past 18 months, as many as 25 children in California have been stricken with a mysterious polio-like virus that has caused paralysis in 5 of the youngsters. Jessica Berman tells us that the paralytic illness is caused by a virus in the same family as polio.
Polio has been eradicated from most of the globe, including the United States, following the development of a vaccine in the mid-1950s. Outbreaks have been reported in countries that include Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Nigeria. Experts were surprised and extremely concerned when more than 24 children in Southern California and the San Francisco Bay Area came down with a mysterious pathogen that, like polio, attacks the central nervous system, causing paralysis. So far, investigators say 5 children have permanently lost the use of one or more limbs. Doctors suspect a virus is to blame, but have not confirmed its presence in all of the children. They've identified enterovirus 68 in the same family as the poliovirus as the culprit in only 2 of the cases. While there are more than 100 enteroviruses throughout the world, ENV68 is rare, says Stephen Tracy, a professor of pathology and microbiology at the University of Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha. Rarer still, he says, is the development of paralysis in children who become infected.
Enteroviruses are very common, very minor diseases, summer colds, that sort of thing.
Newly identified strains of enterovirus have been reported among children in Asia and Australia, causing polio-like syndromes. The polio vaccine does not protect against ENV68 because they are 2 different types of enterovirus. Tracy, however, says a preventive drug could be developed quickly using the polio vaccine as a model.
It's quite possible. We know how to develop enterovirus vaccines now from the yeoman work that went into developing the polio vaccines, both the injectable and the peroral mouth ones.
Because there are so few cases of ENV68 infection, Tracy says drug companies are unlikely to begin work on a vaccine anytime soon. Meanwhile, doctors and public health officials continue to stress paralysis from ENV68 is extremely rare, but they say parents should rush their children to a doctor anytime they see signs of weakness appear suddenly. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up in a few minutes from now, we'll hear from Virginia Tech's Dr. Boris Vanatzer, who just came up with a new system to name and classify Earth's life forms. So with that in mind, it's time for this week's Science World Quick Quiz. From the following, what is the field of science that encompasses the naming and classification of organisms? Is it A, agronomy, B, entomology, or C, taxonomy? Think about it, and good luck. We'll give you the correct answer just a few minutes from now.
You're listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine.
Researchers in Hungary have confirmed something that many dog owners have long suspected, that canines understand our feelings. Using a magnetic resonance scanner, or MRI, scientists found that when it comes to emotions, dogs' brains are similar to those of humans. Steve Barragona has this report from George Putich.
Dogs are not usually relaxed in a lab environment, but with a little petting and lots of treats, they can be trained to sit still even in an MRI scanner. That's how researchers at Hungary's ELTE University were able to get images of their brains at work. Research fellow Attila Andic says it helped them better understand the dog's relationship with humans.
We have known for a long time that dogs and humans share similar social environment, but now our results show that dogs and humans also have similar brain mechanisms to process social information.
After training 11 dogs to stay motionless while their brains were scanned, the researchers checked their neurological responses to about 200 emotionally relevant sounds, from whining and crying to playful barking and laughing. They then compared the responses from human subjects. They found striking similarities. Andic says it opens new possibilities for research.
It establishes a foundation of a new branch of comparative neuroscience, because until now it was not possible to measure the brain activities of a non-primate and the primate brain in a single experiment.
The canine mind is also being studied at Duke University in North Carolina. Co-director of the school's Canine Cognition Center, Evan McLean, says that the Hungarian results are an important step forward. McLean spoke to VOA via Skype.
We've known for a long time that dogs have a lot of behavioral similarities compared to humans, but we don't really know anything, or very little at least, about whether some of these behaviors are represented similarly inside the brain of the dogs.
And what that tells ordinary dog owners, the Hungarian scientists say, is to treat your canine companions as friends, not mere animals, because they evidently understand human feelings. For writer George Putich, I'm Steve Barragona in Washington.
The world's tree cover is disappearing at an alarming rate, 2.5 million square kilometers since 2000. Roseanne Skirbel reports that a powerful forest management computer tool has been designed to stem those losses and target criminal activity.
Fire, illegal logging, and land gobbled up by farms or mining and oil operations are chronic problems in tropical forests worldwide. By the time these activities are discovered, it's often too late to do anything about them, much less determine who's at fault. Enter Global Forest Watch, an online forest monitoring system created by the World Resources Institute and 40 partner groups. At its launch, WRI President Andrew Steer said the program will be a game changer.
It is possible to bring, for the first time ever, really real-time data at a very local level to everybody in the world. And that's what Global Forest Watch is all about.
Global Forest Watch embeds high-resolution satellite images with key information in a simple-to-use interactive website, says WRI's Nigel Sizer, who heads the initiative.
If you can use a Google map to find a friend's house, then you can use Global Forest Watch to understand what's happening to forests in your community, across your country, or even on the other side of the world, and then take action.
Deforestation in the tropics is increasing by about 2,000 square kilometers a year, according to WRI, with half that loss in Brazil and Indonesia. Sizer says Global Forest Watch can help slow that trend.
It allows the government to focus their enforcement efforts in areas where illegal forest clearing is taking place. It allows companies like Nestle and Unilever, who've said, we don't want deforestation in the products that we're selling. They're saying, we're going to use Global Forest Watch so that we know which of our suppliers are doing a good job and which ones are doing a bad job.
NASA has been collecting high-resolution satellite images of the Earth since 1973. And when it made the archive public in 2008, it gave scientists the ability to assess changes in the Earth's landscape. Google Earth Outreach and Earth Engine Manager Rebecca Moore says the aim is to bridge an information gap. The satellite images are so detailed, it's possible to determine whether a section of forest has been logged, burned, or felled by disease. Moore says users can take pictures of what happens on the ground and add to the database. No one hungers for this information more than Ecuadorian Juan Carlos Hintage, who coordinates dialogue among native peoples and governments in 9 Amazon basin countries. He says the information from Global Forest Watch will advance that conversation.
It's a simple way to share our voice and histories. The first time using the Global Forest Watch, we can easily upload alerts, photos for the entire world to see when encroachment happens in our customary forest lands.
Hintage says while he's encouraged about its potential, Global Forest Watch will only be as good as its users, who he says must mobilize to protect the world's forests before it's too late. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Do you think you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz? Let's find out. A few minutes ago, we asked, from the following, what is the field of science that encompasses the naming and classification of organisms? Is it A, agronomy, B, entomology, or C, taxonomy? Well, the answer is C, taxonomy. The word is taken from the Greek words taxis, which means arrangement, and nomia, which means method. Answer A, agronomy, is the branch of soil science that deals with the production of crops as well as land and soil management. And answer B, entomology, is the scientific study of insects. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
Scientists today rely on a 200-year-old biological classification system to help them keep track of every living organism on Earth. The Linnaean system was developed in the 18th century by Carl Linnaeus, a Swedish botanist, physician, and zoologist. But if a new system developed by Dr. Boris Finotzer from Virginia Tech catches on, researchers could have a much more precise method in naming and classifying various emerging species and subspecies of all living organisms on Earth. It would also provide scientists and others with a much more precise and clear universal language that could make communicating about all life on Earth easier. Boris Finotzer joins us for today's one-on-one segment to talk about his new biological classification system and the benefits it could provide. Could you give us a little bit of an overview of your new system?
You know, we have had the Linnaean system to classify and to name biological organisms now for hundreds of years, and it's a really good system, right? It works really well as long as we talk about organisms that we can actually distinguish from each other, so that we can group them together and describe them as groups, species. However, in the last few years, with the new DNA sequencing technology, now we can actually distinguish every single organism within a species. And, of course, Linnaeus did not predict that, and there is no system currently that we can use to systematically name organisms or strains that belong to the same species. In many real-world applications, we need to describe groups of organisms that look and behave exactly the same. Just for example, in the case of pathogens mainly, because within the same species, for example, Bacillus anthracis that causes anthrax, you know, all those bacteria that are in that species, they cause anthrax. They're very similar in how aggressive, how deadly they are. However, we still can distinguish them based on their genome sequence. And it's important to distinguish them because they belong to different populations. And if one of them causes a disease outbreak, we need to have some way to refer to that group within Bacillus anthracis that caused that disease outbreak. If then we have another disease outbreak, we want to know, is it caused by that same population or the same genetic lineage as the other outbreak or a different one.
Now, I understand that your new system is meant to enhance and add depth to the naming convention developed by Linnaeus. How so?
For example, all the dog breeds belong to the same species. However, of course, dogs are all different. The different breeds have different names. But the names do not indicate how the breeds are related to each other. Instead, the system we propose, based on the genome sequence of each breed would get a code that reflects how the different breeds are related to each other. And that then could have a practical application that if you, in the future, buy a breed of dog, most likely you will have the genome sequence of that breed, because it will, in the future, be very, very cheap. And so if then each breed is defined by the range of codes that are assigned to that breed based on our system, then you can get a code for your dog, and you can have a certificate that says, yes, this particular dog belongs to this breed.
With your system in place, will life forms already named and classified retain their current scientific names and classifications?
Oh, yes, for sure. The system is not intended at all to replace species names. It really complements the species names.
When you're applying genetics to the new naming convention and classification system, do you use the entire genome sequence or just a portion of it?
For viruses or bacteria, it is very easy today already to use the whole genome. For eukaryotes that reproduce sexually, there are problems. Once, of course, higher organisms have usually very large genomes, and then it becomes computationally very intensive to even calculate how similar two genomes are. However, animals, they have a diploid genome. We get a copy from father and a copy from the mother. So if you want to give names to different animals based on the similarity of the whole genome, it becomes complicated because we have two copies. Every animal has two copies of a genome. So how can you do that? Examples that we use in our paper is that we can use the mitochondrial genome, which is already used to understand the relationship between different human populations or different other animal populations. Only using the genome of the mitochondrion, which is always inherited from the mother. So we only have one copy of the mitochondrial genome. It's much easier. It's a smaller genome. There's only one copy per animal. And so we could use the mitochondrial genome to assign codes, humans or animals or plants.
Professor, could you give us an example of what would be named under your system?
We propose that every organism, a bacterium, or a virus that's sequenced gets a code based on its similarity to the most similar organism that has already a sequenced genome. And the whole code probably would be very long and would not be used in daily communication. It will have like 24 different positions. Maybe one population would be 0x2y, and the other population would be 0x3y.
What kind of feedback are you receiving from your colleagues and peers regarding your new system?
I receive very good feedback from biologists who study the function of genes. For example, fungal biologists, microbiologists who describe human pathogens or plant pathogens. They think this is a really good approach. However, taxonomists, who are the scientists who classify organisms and also name them, they have a problem with this system. Actually, I think it's a misunderstanding. Some of us think that I want to reinvent classification and species description, but our system has really a different purpose. I completely think we need also species descriptions, and it's good that we change these as we obtain new knowledge. However, in the praxis, for the case of a human disease outbreak or plant disease outbreak where we have the need to use a consistent name, for example, doctors and health officials have one name they can use as soon as there's a disease outbreak because we have a code and that code will stay the same, then it becomes very important to use our system.
That was Dr. Boris Vinatzer, an associate professor in the Department of Plant Pathology, Physiology, and Weed Science at the Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University, or Virginia Tech, in Blacksburg, Virginia. That's it for this edition of Science World. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. You'll find stories, links, and much more. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.